This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Protests resumed today in Iran on the 10th anniversary of a student uprising against the Islamic regime. My guest, Roya Hakakian, grew up in Iran under the Shah and the Ayatollah Khomeini. She was 12 during the revolution and joined in the protests against the Shah. But Hakakian is Jewish. Her father was the headmaster of a Hebrew school in Tehran. And under the revolutionary Islamic government, Jews were subjected to increasing restrictions. She left Iran in 1984 and in 85 was granted political asylum in the U.S. Hakakian is a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and is a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. Last week, we talked about the protests in Iran against the re-election of President Ahmadinejad. We invited her back to talk about her memoir, Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. Roya Hakakian, welcome back to Fresh Air. You describe Jews in Iran as a breed on the verge of extinction, but at the time of the revolution, there were 100,000 Jews in Iran, and it was the second largest community of Jews in the Middle East after Israel. What did it mean to be Jewish under the Shah? Did you have a sense of being marginalized or discriminated against, ghettoized?
It's a wonderful question because it was a bifurcated experience. And I mean bifurcated by the virtue that my own experience varied greatly from what my parents recalled and remembered as their own experience. My father grew up in a very small village, which is now a major town or perhaps even a city, called Khonsar in Iran, 80 years ago. And he had a very rough childhood. And, I talk about that a bit in the book, that even on rainy days, he was not allowed to go to school because Jews were not allowed to walk on the streets on rainy days.
Because
Jews are considered unclean, and as a result of being unclean, when the rain splashes off of a Jewish person, there is the likelihood that, the dirty rain splashing off of that Jewish person could land on a Muslim passing by and therefore dirty the Muslim passerby. Bigotry is hard to explain. But my father's memories were far more different than my experiences. When I was growing up in Tehran, I never felt anything remotely similar to what my father had experienced. And it was growing up in the shadow of his recollections, especially, that was always an intellectual preoccupation for me, because here I was, a Jewish person growing up in Tehran, not at all under the same pressures, but yet living in its shadows and having to reconcile as a result who I was, what I wanted to be, and who I was in relationship to my parents, and whether loyalty really meant that I had to uphold those memories, and if so, to what degree.
Were you growing up in a Jewish neighborhood?
I wasn't. I mean, there were Jews who lived in my area and specifically on my block. But, the beauty of Tehran in the 1960s and the 1970s was that there were no Jewish neighborhoods. In other words, there were no ghettos. Jews of Iran were so assimilated in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s that you really couldn't identify one neighborhood as strictly Jewish. And it was really hard even to tell Jewish people apart from the rest of the, ordinary Iranians out on the streets.
One of your older brothers, when he was a college freshman, participated in a demonstration against the Shah on the campus. And he was detained overnight by SAVAK, which is the Shah's intelligence agency. What impact did that have on the family?
Well, a terrible one, because as a result of that, my father immediately realized that my brothers could not stay in Iran. They were young university students. One of them was 17 at the time and the other one was 19, and that they should be sent to America to be kept safe. And they both came here to the States in 1978, and my oldest brother had already been here from the mid-70s. And that really created a major rupture in my family, from which we, in some ways, never recovered.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, they left in 78. My two youngest brothers left in 78. And by the time my mother and I arrived, it was 1985. And so much had happened in those years, both to them and to us. And it's one thing when families are separated for a job, you know, one person goes to this state, another one goes to another state. It's another thing when in that interim of separation, there is a revolution and a war and displacement and so much more. And it was really hard to sit down and try to catch up with my brothers. I think we never did. There was no way that we could fill each other in on the years that we had been apart.
What were the first signs that you saw in Iran that a revolution was starting?
Oh, street noise. Slogans that would surface on the walls of our streets in the mornings. You know, the walls will be clean and then you would wake up the next day and there would be a slogan written across the wall. It was a very tense time that even in the most quiet moments of the day, you could feel the palpable tension kind of buzzing in the air. And at nights, of course, there were lots and lots of shouts and demonstrations and even shootings. You know, people were out on the streets and guards were after them shooting.
In 1978, there was a national oil company strike which paralyzed the economy of Iran. And that's often looked back now as an example of how powerful a strike in Iran can be. Do you have memories of that 1978 strike?
The queues. You know, the queues were, you know, the most prominent feature of our lives. And I will never forget how odd it was. I mean, it practically transformed the look of the block because from the distribution center, which was at the corner of our block, they had tied a rope to the door handle of the distribution center. And because the queue was so long and people were so desperate for oil, and we wanted to make sure that nobody was cutting in the line, we would pass our buckets through the rope. So even if you left the queue, your bucket would still be in line. And these ropes and these dangling buckets from these ropes were there for weeks, and they had changed the landscape by virtue of them being there, but also simply by the fact that people would aggregate and congregate around these ropes and around their buckets and talk. And it was one of the manifestations of how Iran had come to a standstill in 1978.
Would you describe one of the revolutionary demonstrations that you participated in and what it felt like to be there?
I can't remember one in 1978 or 1979, at least not until the fall of the Shah, that I personally participated in. I was usually on the sidewalks watching. But the one collective event that I did participate in and really was moved by was going up to the rooftop at 9 o'clock in December of 1978 and shouting Allahu Akbar, or God is great. It was a magnificent experience to know that all of us were in it together, to know that everybody in the neighborhood in pitch dark was standing on the rooftop shouting the same thing. It made me realize that social movements, that a collective experience can be such a formative and such a magnificent experience for a young person to have. And I love being there.
My guest is Roya Hakakian, author of the memoir Journey from the Land of No, about growing up Jewish in revolutionary Iran. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roya Hakakian. She wrote a memoir about growing up Jewish in Iran under the Shah and then during the revolution, and it's called Journey from the Land of No. She is also a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. The Jewish community of Tehran sent a delegation to visit the Ayatollah and basically ask, how will Jewish people be treated in Iran in the new Islamic State? And one of the people on the six-member delegation was a close boyhood friend of your father's. What was the message that the delegation got from the Ayatollah Khomeini?
The Ayatollah had actually given them his entire attention, full attention, meaning that there were no other people within his quarters when they visited him in Qom, the holy city, in March or April of 1979. And they were very grateful for that. And the Ayatollah gave a very long and convoluted speech, which had befuddled them in the beginning. But at the end, he made a very important statement, which was sort of the punchline of the speech. And it was, we separate the account of our Jewish community from the blood-sucking Zionists in Israel. And the delegation brought that statement back, and it was immediately painted on the walls of synagogues and Jewish schools and other Jewish establishments throughout Tehran and, you know, wherever, you know, the few other cities where the Jewish community existed in Iran.
It was a strange statement. I mean, he was basically saying, if I understand correctly, our Iranian Jews are good, unlike those Jewish Zionists in Israel who are godless and horrible. So our Jews are okay, but there's lots of other Jews that aren't okay. And you say the phrase that the Ayatollah said about separating the Iranian Jews from the godless Zionists or the blood-sucking Zionists of Israel, that phrase was painted on the walls of every synagogue by nightfall. What was the point of painting it? To spread the message that this is what the Ayatollah thinks? And was that meant to reassure people or to scare people or what?
It was their way of delivering the Ayatollah's message to the followers of the Ayatollah throughout Iran.
So it was a way of saying, leave us alone, like we're the good Jews. The Ayatollah says,
cool.
We're the good Jews, leave us alone.
Yes. We have the stamp of the Ayatollah's approval. Look, you know, it's true you want to fight Israel and the Palestinian issue is a major issue, but we're the good Jews that the Ayatollah okayed.
How long did you stay the good Jews in the Ayatollah's esteem?
The Iranian Jews have consistently been categorized as the good Jews since then. I mean, that statement was fundamentally important for the Iranian Jewish community because it was really a way to say, look, whatever it is that you feel about Israel or the Zionists or the wrongs that have been done to the Palestinians, we have had nothing to do with it. That's all politics beyond our borders. We have always been here. We have existed in Iran long before there was a government of Israel, long before even there was Islam in Iran, and we want to keep it that way. It was a way of delineating very strict boundaries between the Jewish community in Iran and the political issues surrounding Israel.
But eventually, non-Muslim store owners and restaurant owners had to put signs on their doors saying this store or this restaurant is owned by a non-Muslim, which was certainly a form of discrimination. And you say that a new hardliner type principal took over your school, and she even wanted to convert the Jews to Islam.
God knows she tried very hard, and God also knows that she failed.
How did your parents, who were very observant Jews, feel about this?
They actually were very scared, but in a way prepared, because they always had their own previous experiences to refer to.
Because there was so much anti-Semitism when they were growing up.
Yes. And so they had that background. And to them, it was like, oh, so it's back to that again. And so they were ready for it in ways that we weren't. My generation wasn't. But, you know, on the other hand, several other of my classmates found it extremely comical because, you know, there was this fundamentalist woman. And I do believe that fundamentalism behaves in the same way across all religions. And, you know, she sounded awkward and she was a cartoonish character. And we basically sat in the back of the school lunchroom and really giggled the whole time. I mean, even as she spoke, we would mimic her and laugh during her entire talk.
Your parents decided it was time to leave during, I think it was during the Iran-Iraq War. And is it right to assume that part of it was the growing amount of anti-Semitism and also just the dangers of living in Iran during the war?
Well, let me make one clarification, because as an Iranian, I think I need to make this point that the anti-Semitic behavior or measures that were implemented in Iran during those years were implemented by the government, and the people, our ordinary neighbors and friends, were not, in fact, falling in line with what the regime was dictating. It's very important for me to say that I believe that the Iranian regime has been, ever since 1979, much more regressive than the general Iranian population. And it was the regime that wanted to implement anti-Semitic measures, and in many ways, the Iranian people wouldn't go along with it. The regime had made it very difficult for those Iranians who were not ideological, who were not sympathetic to the regime, to make a good living. So if you were not a student who could, say, bring in a letter of recommendation from the local mullah at the mosque, you would have less chances of getting into the university, or at least get into a good university. And, you know, so it became very difficult for ordinary Iranians who weren't on the side of the regime to hope for a great future. And, of course, 1984 was the fourth year of war with Iraq. Everything was rationed, and there were shortages of the basic staples of life. And there was no end in sight, so leaving was a very logical thing to do.
You're in touch with a lot of people in Iran now through the human rights work that you do. Do you still have family or friends in Iran?
I have a lot of friends, but they're not friends that I had when I was growing up. You know, the beauty of being a writer and being away from Iran, if there is any beauty about it, is that some of my work, without even my own knowledge, made their way back to Iran, and people eventually brought me anthologies of women's poetry that have been published in Iran in recent years that include some of my poems. And so as a result of these things and these exchanges, I find that even though I can't go back to Iran, my work goes back to Iran, and there's a wonderful sense of returning without physically returning and connecting to a whole new range of people I didn't know before, but you know, but people who read and connect with me on other levels and with whom I now correspond.
For a lot of Jewish people around the world, the Iranian President Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust and his real hatred of Israel and statements like it should be wiped off the map, these are very frightening things to Jewish people around the world, and I wonder how you interpret it. You know, knowing Iran the way you do, having lived there, what do you hear when you hear him make those statements?
I hear the man that that people in Iran want to get rid of say yet another strange and unbelievable and stupid remark. You know, it doesn't startle me or astound me as much as it does others, because I know that there is another Iran. I know that there is an Iran that objects to the man who denies the Holocaust. And I have always found that what the rest of the world needs to discover is the fact that even as he uttered these things, even as Ahmadinejad denied the Holocaust, there were journalists and other intellectuals writing and working inside Iran who objected to him and who were imprisoned as a result. So for me, the struggle is always to show the rest of the world that there is in Iran a strong criticism against the very man that everybody else objects to.
Well, Roya Hakakian, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
I was delighted to be with you. Thanks.
Roya Hakakian is a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. Her memoir is called Journey from the Land of No.